You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 4th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program to discuss his piece in Bloomberg, Jonathan Alter, his piece on why Democrats should be embracing cuts to entitlements. Also on the program today, shocking news. Right-wing propagandists are paid to propagandize. Also shocking, New York police lie and get caught lying in a trial against a Occupy protester. Also on the program today, how the poor are being hurt by the sequester and why jobs suck in the wake of the Great Recession. And a couple of interesting pieces on just where the Republicans are in terms of their willingness to engage in a deal to avoid the sequester and what that means for proposals like Democrats should embrace cuts to entitlements. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jonathan Alter. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Jonathan Alter. He is a columnist for the Bloomberg View. He is an MSNBC contributor, and his latest book, The Center Holds Obama and His Enemies, is available now on Amazon for pre-order. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Thanks. Just to be clear, that book's not out until late May or so. But
always good to pre-order
it.
All right. Well, pre-order that thing, folks. Let's get it up there on the Amazon rankings. All right. So, Jonathan, I want to talk about your latest piece in the Bloomberg View, where you argue that Democrat legislators and lawmakers and should sign on to the proposals that President Obama has put forth to cut Social Security via the CPI, the chain CPI, and just in general, I guess, to sign on for entitlement cuts. The argument that you make, I believe, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that ultimately it is because entitlement cuts in the to benefit cuts in the future would protect discretionary spending now. Is that a fair?
Yeah, I do think that's a pretty good way of summarizing my argument. You know, by 2030, we're going to have twice as many retirees as we had in 1995. The baby boomers are going to present a severe burden on this country. And any liberal Democrat, and I count myself as one of them, you know, has his head in the sand if they think that these programs do not need to be reformed. If they're not, basically seniors will eat the budget. And it'll be very, very hard for us to make the investments in pre-K and in medical and scientific research and all of the seed corn that our discretionary budget provides. And it'll be really hard to maintain the social safety net for people in need. And so this is, you know, something where the dishonesty of the Republicans and their, you know, efforts to wreck these programs has blinded at least some liberals to the necessity to rethink some old assumptions about them.
Now, I count myself as one of those who has been blinded in that respect. And so now we know that Social Security, if the estimates of by the trustees is correct, that by 2033, we will receive 22 to 23% less in our benefits under Social Security. Medicare has a lot bigger problems. On the Social Security front, we know that we're taking in 8% less than we traditionally have in terms of income. If we were to get back up to that point by raising the cap, not totally lifting it, but simply raising the cap to that point, we would eliminate half of those cuts. So we'd be looking at about 10, 12% cuts 20 years out. Medicare, of course, is a lot less sustainable. However, we know that the main driver of that is the cost of medical expenses. So let me ask you this. What is the evidence that if we were to go ahead, because we know President Obama has already put this on the table, it's on his website, the chain CPI cuts, the cuts to Medicare benefits. We know that this is already on the table, but what is the evidence that if we were to agree, because you're making ultimately a political argument, is that not right? I mean, you're saying that Democrats should sign on to these cuts because it will free up money for discretionary, for these other programs. But there's no evidence that that would actually happen that way, is there?
Well, that's where it comes to whether you trust the president or not. I mean, that this is his basic view. He's trying to prevent further cuts in discretionary spending by making some of these changes in entitlements. What I'm talking about,
but
Sam,
it's not just
in some ways
the Republicans
ways
have agency here, right?
Because I'm for, you know, raising the cap. You and I agree on a lot of the specifics. What I'm trying to get people to think about on the left is to move away from this notion of these programs being entirely sacrosanct. And my column is really about the history of this and about the way Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson looked at these programs. First of all, they never called them entitlements, which is
wait a second, Jonathan. But let's talk about the reality here. Is, I mean, the fact is that the Republicans have to sign off on this, and there's no evidence that the Republicans, if they were to get entitlement cuts today for future benefits, would or social insurance, however we want to refer to it, if they were to get these cuts, that they would then spare other programs. I mean, so I'm saying,
no,
from a political standpoint.
No, you can't. it's true in the long term. You can't, you know, lock in future Congresses to adequate levels of discretionary spending. But what you can say is you can move our system from one where we're basically headed for a place in just about 10 years, 10, 15 years, where the budget is almost entirely seniors, military, and interest on the national debt. That's not where we want to be, Sam. We want
to. No, I understand that, but we're talking about.
So we have to do a lot of things on entitlements. Raise the cap, absolutely, but not. But the main thing we need to do is we need to get out of this mindset where we say that, you know, any changes to these things is somehow a violation of liberal principles. I am totally and unalterably opposed to voucherizing and privatizing these programs because I look at what they were originally supposed to do, and that is completely against the intention of these programs. But how something like the cost of living increase is assessed, which wasn't even in the original Social Security original Medicare, is a completely different question.
Well, no, but it's
the structural integrity
of these
programs.
A cut is a cut. I mean, we agree that the CPI.
First of all, it's not a cut. If you change the assessment of the cost of living increase, that's a new assessment on what benefit increases would be.
But when we talk about changing the CPI,
is not a cut.
It is a cut in the ability.
That's Orwellian to call it a cut.
It is a cut.
It's not a cut.
Wait
it's
a second.
Scaring seniors. It's not cutting their benefits.
It is diminishing the buying power of seniors relative
not
to today.
Not necessarily.
No, no. I mean, by anybody who's done the numbers on this, that we know that elderly expenses are actually higher than even the cost of living increases that they get today. They are rising at a faster rate. Everyone, there is no economist out there who doesn't presume this is a cut. Otherwise, why would we recommend it?
You don't do that to needy seniors. We're eliding the basic issue here. You're talking about very specific questions that relate to chain CPI and these kinds of things. I'm willing to be talked out of support for chain CPI.
If it's not a
I'm
cut,
not wedded to any of these particular reforms.
If it's not
my
a cut
point,
to benefits, why would we recommend it? How would it help the...
Sam, what you're talking about is you're talking... We're talking... The reason we're talking past each other is that you're talking about specific reforms down into the numbers. This is not the point of my column. You might be successful in convincing me that changing to chain CPI is not the right thing to do right now at this point in the negotiations, et cetera, et cetera. That's not what I'm trying to convince you of. I'm trying to convince you of the idea that we must means test these programs. And if you want to say that needy seniors should have a more generous cost of living increase that's not chain CPI, fine. But wealthier seniors must pay more. I'm going to be eligible for retirement in 5 years, and my benefits need to be taxed out the wazoo.
The
point being that Franklin Roosevelt designed these programs as insurance against need. Keep that in mind. They're not entitlement programs.
60%.
That word wasn't even used until
seniors.
The '70s.
Jonathan, 60% of seniors
rely.
60% of seniors rely on Social Security for more than 50%.
I want to protect those people.
Okay. All right. So
I want to protect those people.
The argument that you'd always use,
Sam, is, well, if you don't give the other 40% of wealthier seniors, if you don't give them this too, then you turn it into welfare.
My argument would be, I have no problem with means testing. The most efficient way of means testing is simply to raise taxes on the wealthy. And you can do it on the front end. You don't have to build another mechanism to do it on the back end. And we could means test in that regard. But so the argument you're making is a political one. And my argument would be there is no evidence that if we were to recommend, if Democrats were to sign on as you want them to cuts in future benefits, that this would in any way protect discretionary spending. In fact, I would say, based upon what Gene Sperling said about the sequester, that it was that built the DNA of the sequester had entitlement reform in it, that this was supposed to force some type of entitlement reform, that In fact, the reality is such, because Republicans exist, they are the party they are, that that this in no way precludes the cuts of discretionary spending. I mean, we can talk about, you know, down the road or how we would means test. There are more efficient ways of doing it than I think the ones that you're suggesting. But from a political standpoint, this seems to me to be a complete non-starter, and in fact puts both entitlement cuts and discretionary spending on the table simultaneously.
Well, there's going to be some discretionary spending, but cuts in discretionary spending. But my assessment of where Sperling and the White House is that, you know, the grand bargain that they were after, and kind of a mini grand bargain that might still be possible, would protect these investments that are now part of the sequester in exchange for some structural changes in our long-term structural deficit, which entitlements are very much a part of. So, you know, there is a long-term, short-term trade-off.
What's to prevent Republicans from coming back and saying we demand more cuts on either the
Well, they're always going to demand more cuts, but that doesn't mean the president's going to give them more cuts. So that depends on Democrats staying in power.
But
10 years from now, you know, even after we've got chained CPI or some other thing, if you have a Republican president who wants to take a machete to important discretionary programs, you know, we're going to have to prevent that from happening.
But if we have
in the meantime,
Democratic
we need
control
to take,
of these
we need
things.
To take rational steps to put these programs on a sustainable basis. And the point that you are not acknowledging is, and by this kind of happy talk about Social Security, these programs are not on a sustainable basis. They're not.
Why don't we simply raise? I mean, we can eliminate the problems with Social Security that you're talking about by simply removing the cap. We can deal with Medicare.
Removing the cap. You say simply, you know, that is the heaviest of heavy lifts. I favor it. And I think that you could get some adjustments in the cap that could provide real revenue. But this kind of liberal fantasy of, well, we just remove the cap, and then that's the only argument we have to make.
But how is the notion that we're going to keep
argument?
But how is the notion that we're going to prevent future cuts to discretionary spending any less fantastical? I mean, what is the
because the Democratic president is all you need to prevent those draconian cuts or these idiotic cuts
just saw
we have right now in the sequester.
We have a Democratic president, and those cuts have now kicked in.
But that's because they made this Procrustean bed in July of 2011. But moving forward, you know, because they had him by the short hairs on the debt ceiling.
But
you know,
they'll
so
have him on the
forward,
short hairs in a year from now, too, won't they?
Well, no, I don't think so. I don't think so.
But I mean, this is my point:
is that the
most recent history we have, starting as of Friday,
is not the same as it was in July of 2011.
But it seems to me that it seems to me that there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever from a political standpoint. We put aside the notion of the implications of cutting Social Security or Medicare, the policy implications. From a political standpoint, there doesn't seem to be a shred of evidence that in any way that if we cut Social Security 20 years down the road, for no one over the age of 55, or Medicare, we raise the eligibility age, forcing people to buy private insurance. There's no evidence whatsoever this is going to forestall any discretionary cuts. I mean,
well,
it seems to me just as fantastical.
I reject both of those reforms. I think that, you know, the idea of, both of the ideas that you just mentioned, I think would be bad ideas and actually cost everybody more money. But look, there are a lot of reform ideas on the table. The two that you just mentioned, I think, are dumb. That's not my argument. My argument is that Democrats have to start thinking about this in a real way and not just say, we can't means test because then it turns it into welfare, or just raise the cap or eliminate the cap and that'll take care of everything. Those are not reason. I agree with them, but they don't put the Democrats in a a rational and relevant place moving forward with this demographic bomb. So what I'm asking for is for smart people like you to give more thought to the long-term problems and not just assume, well, that's Pete Peterson and these, you know, these deficit hawk Simpson Bowles types who we don't have to pay any mind to. A lot of their remedies, especially the recent Simpson Bowles remedies, which I think are almost pathetic, as if there was no election, are wrong. But what I'm suggesting to you, Sam, is the basic diagnosis, the actuarial and demographic, you know, trends are irrefutable.
Well, I would agree. I mean, we're going to, at one point,
we need to get a handle on that.
If I stipulate that, you know, if we stipulate that the long-term debt may be an issue for the sake of this argument, but I think the answer is just as well that we are significantly lower in terms of tax revenues relative to GDP. We could raise those taxes. That's a rational expression. But from a political standpoint,
I agree.
We have the deficit in the past 4 years, the fastest rate since the 50s or 40s. And 7% of the population knows this. We know what happens when any type of cuts to Medicare happen, even if they're not benefit cuts. The Republicans run on that and they win. And so what you're making, it seems to me, is a political argument.
No, they didn't win on – they won on that.
In 2010, they won.
2010, they won on that for a lot of different reasons that partly relate to the Democrats doing a terrible job of defending themselves that year. But
well, it's very hard to defend when you take a step in that direction, you cut Medicare payments.
Well, that's not a reason to irresponsibly – condemn future generations to having nothing in discretionary income.
Well, wait
income.
A second. I think,
like you,
but
people like
I don't think
eat
I think you're doing
benefit.
That in the same way. In fact, I think if Democrats were to embrace Social Security and Medicare cuts, and then go into this next election, we'd have a far more greater chance of future Republican Congresses cutting those discretionary funds.
Well, not if the Republicans have voted for it. I mean, the problem with the Obamacare, Medicare
well, they could vote for it today. You're calling for Democrats to vote for it. You're calling for Democrats to vote for it. They voted for the $500 billion in Medicare cuts as well, and they still demagogued it.
No, I don't. I think if there was some kind of a grand bargain, they would have to find other issues to demagogue. Because it would be very hard for them to vote. In other
your
words,
faith in the Republicans.
So you're fighting a last war, Sam. I mean, if they do a deal, some kind of a grand bargain that's reasonable, that's on the president's, you know, that's acceptable to the president, they then in 2014 will have a hard time running against that. So you're fighting the last
Paul
war.
Ryan had the same cuts in his budget to Medicare as the president did, and they ran against
it. I know. That was chutzpah. But
they got chutzpah.
You know,
that's the reality.
Basically, Sam, you're making an argument for gridlock, and that's just not a responsible argument right now.
I can't change who the Republicans are, but I can see what they do.
You're making an argument. You're making it sound as if any creative thinking about entitlements is a sellout to Republicans. And
well,
that's
I think
just
it's
not
I,
responsible.
I don't. I mean. I don't think it's a question of it being a sellout to Republicans. It seems to me that on both a policy level, it's problematic. But frankly, on a political level, it seems to be malpractice. Because at that point, I mean, if the Democratic Party does not protect
responsible,
these...
you've got to deal with these issues. You're not a baby boomer. I am. Okay,
I'm pretty close.
My Grateful Dead buddies are going to be.
I saw the dead
there,
seven times.
In the seniors, getting so much.
Maybe I saw you in one of those shows.
So much more. Do you have any idea how much more we're going to take out than we put in?
I know that on Social
lives?
Security, your average person
Remember,
on Social Security
FDR
actually puts in.
Said it's supposed to be insurance against need. That's what insurance is. If you don't get in the car wreck, you don't get the insurance at all from your insurance company for the car accident. If you've been driving safely, nothing happens. If my house doesn't burn down, I don't get the money.
I understand.
No,
and
so,
I think that we can certainly increase we could
and,
listen
and that, and
we can increase the premiums.
Get
we can increase the premiums You get more out of Social Security than you put in for the average person. You get about three times more in Medicare.
But you can just
have the rich pay more premiums. And that's a very simple solution. And it's actually more consistent with what our tax numbers have been in the past.
And I favor that. Where we don't agree is that it's for you, it's lift the caps or nothing. And I think that's not enough. That's just not creative enough. It's not realistic enough.
Aren't you then negotiating if the solution is to raise the caps, to get back to a traditional level of income being subject to the payroll tax? Right now we're about 8% lower. I mean, isn't that the most rational response? And from a political standpoint, if the Democrats are proposing benefit cuts, then who is going to propose the most rational response, which is to raise revenue?
I agree. I mean, I wrote in my column, I am for lifting those caps. But what I'm also for, and which I can't get you to accept, is that this old argument that somehow, you know, these programs need to be preserved in amber, that we can't take a hard look.
I actually think that we should increase benefits
and
lower the retirement age if that constitutes not being in amber when it comes to Social Security. And I think that we need a buy-in
for Medicare. Lower the retirement age on Social Security?
Of course.
On Medicare, we want to lower the eligibility age for Medicare, because the government Medicare is much more efficient than private insurance. So I'm very much against what, you know, Joe Lieberman really screwed the country when he killed the idea of
55-year-old
sending Medicare down into 55-year-olds. So we agree on that, but lowering the retirement age from 65?
I think that we need to drop it for a couple of years to deal with our employment crisis. But we also know that there has been a massive failure of 401ks. We know that when we talk about the historical perspective on Social Security as one third of the three-legged stool, that those other legs have now crumbled in terms of efficacy. We know that your generation, the baby boomer generation, has depleted so much of their 401ks that people have a fraction of what they're going to need. I mean, so the idea of cutting benefits on Social Security for that cohort in particular is going to be devastating to them, and we're going to end up having more poor people who are going to end up draining more out of that discretionary spending that we're talking about.
I don't want to do that. I don't want to hurt those people. And this is what I think is a little demagogic coming from the left, is that anytime somebody talks about making changes, you say you want to hurt those needy people. I don't.
Let's just raise taxes. Let's just raise taxes. If you're making more.
There's a lot of other things you can do. You know, you can also tax the benefits.
We do tax the benefits now. If you make over,
but you can tax them at a higher level.
I'm all for raising taxes. I'm all for raising taxes. We just do it as an income
tax.
We just do it as an income
tax. Payroll tax.
We can do it.
Lifting the cap.
Let's raise income tax rates, and that takes care of it. I mean, in retirement, if you're making
already, they're not paying on it as ordinary income. So, you know, there's many breaks in there.
If you're making over $25,000, if you're making over $50,000 in retirement, you're paying taxes on that. And half of that is Social Security benefits.
A whole lot of other, you know, you used to not at all. So they changed that in the 80s, so you pay some taxes. But there's a lot of little, you know, things that have been written in to the tax code, because senior lobby has always been very powerful. So there's lots of little breaks here. And the assumption that,
I will join you in a call for raising income taxes, and I will call you for that means testing on the front end. I got no problem with that. It's the most efficient way of doing it. As every study I've read has said, we already means test Medicare Part B and D.
We agree, because there are a number of liberals I heard from them in the last couple of days who go with this old argument that if you apply means testing in various ways, that you undercut political support.
We can just do it by
long-term.
Progressive taxation is the most effective means test in the world.
Good. Okay. Well, we agree.
And,
we agree. So means testing. So we can agree on the concept of means testing entitlements, and that takes us a long way to where we need to be.
I mean, it's a semantic argument, I guess. I mean, I think when you say but either way, from a policy standpoint, but from a political standpoint, to call for cuts in future benefits now, at the hopes of saving discretionary spending, I think the sequester has already proved that doesn't work. That's just not where the Republicans are. And if we can get to the point where we have a Democratic-controlled House and Senate and president, which is going to be the only way we can forestall at least a huge pressure to cut those discretionary spending, well, then we'll also be in a position to raise taxes.
Well, you don't know what they're going to get in return, so you've rejected the deal without knowing what it is.
Well, no, I am.
You don't know what the White House
doesn't matter what
return.
I do with the deal. It matters what the Republicans do. And
but you're assuming a bad deal on the part of the White House. Maybe they'll come up with a good deal.
Well, no, I'm just looking at what they're offering now and what the Republicans have done, and they've said no. I mean, CPI is sitting on the front page of the White House. Means testing Medicare. It's on the White House website. You know, I mean, they have. I think the Republicans have proven.
Yeah,
that
they don't care. They don't care about anything except cutting taxes. So, and anything that the Democrats propose is
indeed.
Is,
and so, it seems to me that that politically speaking, I mean, that's ultimately what the argument is that we're not protecting discretionary spending by offering this. All we're doing is opening up another front in which they can cut.
No, but you're,
which
you're,
is
you're
incredibly
driving a wedge.
Unpopular
you,
with it, the American
you're driving
public.
A wedge on the Republican side. I mean, if you're Obama, you're very smart to put entitlements on the table. Because then you're calling their bluff and you're driving a wedge on the Republican side. So just because they haven't accepted the deal doesn't mean that it wasn't smart to offer it.
But to whom? Well,
for Democrats to just dig in and say, "Oh, we're not going to offer anything." That doesn't get you very far.
Well,
you want to get a lot of this behind you and deal with immigration.
If I'm running for the House in 2014, I want to look across my Republican opponent and says, that guy voted to cut your Medicare and Social Security because that's going to give me 5 to 10 points in the polls when I run against that guy. I mean, from a political standpoint.
Well, that's where
no
you want it to come up for a vote.
What's that?
You know, I mean,
well, the
and,
Democrats
and
can't force it through a vote in the House. That's on the Republicans. Right. I mean, so at the end of the day, this is just whether or not the Republicans accept this, whether, you know, if I'm a Democrat in the House, there's absolutely no political benefit for me to do this, regardless of what my policy thinking is on it. I happen to believe and hope that those Democrats also see that from a policy standpoint, it's a bad idea, because if anything, I mean, the number one cost of all these drivers is the cost of health care, not the cost of Medicare, but the cost of health care. And
but see, Sam, of course, that's just become a platitude at this point, you know, but what you're not accepting is that if you go the kind of Grover Norquist of the left route and have people sign what amounts to a pledge, I will never cut benefits, that then makes it very hard for them to do means testing, because if you tax those benefits, a lot of people would define that as a cut, even though the only people getting cut would be the wealthy. So the Democrats just can't go down this road of imitating Grover Norquist.
I don't think that Democratic constituencies would ever have a problem with their electeds imposing a higher tax.
No, but what would happen is just what you just suggested. The Republicans would say, "Oh, he pledged he wouldn't cut benefits, but then he voted for H.R. 19, which
it raises taxes on wealthy
taxes,
people.
But that has the effect of cutting their benefits.
Well, but I think that American public, we've seen poll after poll that suggests that if that Republican steps up and says that Democratic guy raised taxes on the wealthy, I think that you're politically in a good position.
They'll say that guy raised taxes on seniors. That's what they'll say.
Well, you can raise it on everybody who just hits a certain wealth level.
Well, no, but they will just argue. I mean, so this is why all I'm saying is that signing these letters, we will never, ever, ever cut benefits. It sounds good. It's just a Grover Norquist of the left attitude. And Democrats
except
need to get
80% of the American public agrees with that sentiment, and not so with Grover Norquist. I mean, isn't that the problem with the Norquist pledge? Is that the American public is in favor of raising taxes?
No, the problem with the pledge is that it's, well, it's a dumb idea, but the real problem with the pledge is that it's a pledge, and this is not rational policy making, and that's what I want to keep Democrats from locking themselves into things by saying never, ever, ever, and getting up on their soapboxes and just try to deal with these long-term problems. Don't pretend that Social Security and Medicare are on a sustainable path just because they can find, you know, some study that says so, that demographics are not subtle.
Nobody's pledging to make Medicare or Social Security unsustainable. What they're pledging to is not by making it sustainable, but not by doing it through cutting benefits. That's all.
Here's where you and I should compromise.
Okay.
The way these statements should read should not be, we are against cutting benefits. They can read, we are against cutting benefits for people who need them. If you add that, for people who need them, those five words should be in every Democratic document. Otherwise, these programs are unsustainable. They need to be for people who need them, not just the very poor. There are a lot of middle-class seniors who need these benefits to live on and to get by and have decency, which is what the, you know, what these programs were intended to. I don't need it, and I should get very little of it. And that's the concept that we need to start to, get into people's heads.
I would be the first to be in line to raise your taxes and think that everybody should, Jonathan.
No, you're talking about raising my taxes to pay, you know,
for other people's Medicare. It's just it's the same
people.
Thing except for
I'm
that
talking
way.
About
in
my,
the,
I'm talking about my, I mean, I think it would go down easier if I am for lifting the caps, but since that's not going to happen, right? I mean, they could be maybe lifted a little bit. It's up to 113,000 this year. But, you know, what I would be more for is paying, you know, 90% tax on my Social Security benefits.
Well, I mean,
I get a little tiny check.
I mean, look, money's fungible. If we raise your taxes back up to sort of pre-Clinton levels, then we will get that money. And
right,
if
that's the way
raising
that's
the cap
way,
is impossible.
Done. Not,
raising the cap
all,
is impossible. We certainly
tax,
can't count on funding of discretionary spending. That's my.
I mean,
my sense.
We want to move away from the payroll tax anyway. It's a terribly regressive tax. But
not if we raise
really,
the cap.
What really should happen, I think, is that the means testing should be on your individual benefits, and we should have a principle that nobody,
Jonathan,
over a certain
as a policy,
level,
on a policy
gets,
level,
gets back more than they
no
put in.
One. I have seen no data that suggests that if we were to do that, that we could actually with building that apparatus. I'm looking at a study by the Center on Economic Policy Research that shows at the very least for Social Security, if we means test, the net value of that, unless you start going into people who are making less than $40,000 a year in retirement, is virtually nil because of the cost of actually means testing. I mean, so from a policy standpoint, that does not put us on a sustainability path anyways. I mean, so that's the thing is that, you know, it's tough to draw the line between what is policy and what is politics in this situation. I just don't see the efficacy of either, frankly, but we will.
Yeah, well, but the problem with your position, Sam, is you just want to kind of do nothing.
No, I want to raise the taxes.
Like, that's kind of like Israel saying, yeah, the demographics are terrible. Yeah, we really should move to a two-state solution now, but the politics are just too daunting, so we're not going to do anything.
Well, I'm saying we should raise the taxes.
I know, but that's not happening right now.
Well,
I think the extent that we're not going to raise taxes is
probably direct proportion to our ability to fund discretionary spending as well.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I got to go.
I know.
It's been a wonderful discussion.
I've held you much longer.
Always great Great to talk to you.
I really appreciate you taking the time and going over. All right. Thank you, Jonathan.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. I got to tell you right now, folks, Jonathan said he told me from the beginning he only had 15 minutes. I hope I didn't make him late. I appreciate him staying longer. I am genuinely mystified by this notion. And frankly, I think there's some type of rose-colored glasses involved in this, because if we cannot get taxes to be raised on the cap, just the cap, when we know that we're taking in 8% less on Social Security income than we have traditionally, if we know that we are taxes relative to GDP is 3 or 4 points less, if we know that the deficit is a function of the recession that we had, if we know all these things and we still cannot raise taxes on wealthy, I'm not suggesting we wouldn't necessarily do this now until a better economic position. But if we know that we can't do this in 5 years, how is it that we can assume that somehow those forces that are preventing us from doing that are going to say, well, since you've cut benefits for people in Social Security and Medicare, we're now going to really fund discretionary spending for the poor? I don't understand how that works. Nobody's been able to present me with that evidence. And I've asked Jonathan, I've asked other people. I just haven't seen it, because I don't think it exists. The reality is that this offer, for better or for worse, I would suggest worse, has already been put out there by the president. The president has already offered cut future benefits of Social Security via the chain CPI, cut Medicare benefits, and yet the Republicans still have allowed for this discretionary cuts that are hurting the poor. I've got, we'll talk about this in the second half of the show. But the fact of the matter is that if the sequestration, if we're to believe Gene Sperling in writing to Bob Woodward, that entitlement reform was built into the sequester, into the DNA of the sequester. In other words, the sequester was supposed to bring about, was supposed to be this cudgel to bring about cuts in entitlement reform, and it didn't work. That, to me, seems to be absolute evidence that it won't work. That if we were to cut future benefits in Social Security, I mean, assuming for the moment that I am pie in the sky, thinking that there isn't a problem with the system of Medicare, because those elderly are still going to have to pay for overpriced health insurance. And assuming that I'm pie in the sky, believing that Social Security problems can be reversed by payroll tax, there's no evidence that cutting those benefits are going to lead to the policy outcomes that have been that are being projected by Jonathan's column. And I believe there is ample evidence that, politically speaking, Democrats calling for entitlement cuts now would actually lead to more cuts in discretionary spending, because they will lose at the ballot box. And then we will have an undivided government solely of Republicans who will then proceed to cut discretionary spending. Because at the end of the day, they just don't want taxes. They just don't want to pay for these things. That's it. But I do appreciate, I mean, look, Jonathan knew why I was inviting him on. And there's a lot of people who wouldn't come on. So I definitely, I think he deserves a lot of respect for coming on, knowing that, you know, we've had this argument before many times in the in the green room at MSNBC. So I appreciate him coming on. Very good sport to do so. I still am just, I'm still left with this wondering, like, what is the political value? Even if you believe that there's a policy value, but we cannot control the future spending of Congress. I mean, have we not learned that lesson time and time again? That we can't even project out 6 months into what Congress is going to do. Never mind 20 years. It's just that all that will happen if we cut Social Security and Medicare now is that they will put that in their pocket, whoever the they is, and then they will proceed to cut spending on the poor. So it's a false choice, in my estimation. It's not only a false choice, it is a poor prescription to avoid that false choice. All right, we're going to take a break. Before we do, folks, I would love to have this debate on MSNBC where we hear this perspective go unchallenged virtually every time it's raised. There's a couple of shows where you don't see that, but they are far and few between. You would not see this debate on CNN, certainly not Fox. You wouldn't see it on ABC or NBC News. Or CBS. You will not hear it on 90% of the radio, regardless of what radio you listen to. There's a couple of shows like this. You'll hear a debate like this. But I don't know if they would be able to have this debate, frankly. I mean, I have a debate like this because I feel like I'm in a unique position to have it, where people like Jonathan will come on the show, know that he's going to have that fight and still come on. And so if you can support this program, it's in both our interests to do so. And if you can afford to do it, by all means, I hope you will. You can become a member at majority.fm. Click the become a member at the top and become a member. It's pennies a day. I mean, it's a lot of pennies. It's 33 pennies. You wouldn't want to walk around with that in your pocket. So in a way, I'm unburdening you of having to walk around with so much change all the time. Who likes that, right? Think of how much more space you'd have in your house if you didn't have to dump all that change out and put it in that big bowl. Then have your kid come around and steal it. And then have to deal with the moral dilemma of saying to your child, hey, don't steal. And they just look at you like it's change. It's pocket change. And then you're like, okay. Make your kid put that change down and say, you know what, kid? We're going to send this to the Majority Report.
Every penny you waste, you're taking out of.
All right, you can support the program by buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Organic, coupon code majority. Folks, we're talking to Credo. I think they're coming back. I've been talking to a lot of people about the political actions they're taking, and they want to support the show. I want them to support the show, so hopefully in the coming weeks we will work that out. Maybe sooner rather than later. I don't know. I'm trying to work everything I'm doing now. I'm trying to work around when my baby's coming. And it's going to be any day now. We are 3.5 days away from due date. So the kid is coming. I don't know when. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of the program, the IM is on right now. You want to tell me what you thought about that? I guess we had a little debate. With Jonathan Alter, give me a call. Tell me what you thought. You want to IM me? Majority FM. Jeb Bush, no pathway to citizenship. Is that right? Did he come up with that? All right, folks. See you in the better half.